Hello and welcome to this episode of Let's Talk About, curated by Kangaroo Minds. I'm Vedika, and today we're going to talk about memories and mental health. To have this conversation with us, we have with us Shreya Sakseria. Shreya is the founder and CEO of Lamha, the memory jar company. Shreya founded Lamha based on her internationally published research, which centers around depicting that even spending up to 5 minutes with memory jars can lead to increased happiness, enhanced well-being, as well as reducing loneliness. Shreya is also an award-winning novelist, as well as a three-time Early Star Chair. Shreya graduated from Princeton with the highest honors in psychology, entrepreneurship, finance, and Eastern European studies. Before we begin the conversation, however, we'd like to put out a trigger warning for our audiences. If at any point during this conversation, should you find yourself feeling triggered or distressed, we urge you to take a step back and look after yourself. Should you need any additional support resources, you can also find them on our website. On that note, hi Shreya, welcome to the conversation. I'm really looking forward to doing this with you.
Thank you for having me. I feel like we've been discussing this for so long and I'm glad we made it.
I know, I'm absolutely looking forward to actually sharing the insights that we've spoken about for such a long time with the audiences. And I know you're going to bring in a lot of interesting points, not just around memories, mental health, and your research, but also around the work that, you know, you're doing in this space. So I think before, you know, just to start off the conversation, I'm going to ask you, I think one question which a lot of people must be asking you and which kind of ties in the whole conversation is that how deeply do you think, like, you know, our memories are linked with our mental health and our emotional state?
I think that's a really interesting question. And also, I could spend 4.5 hours at least talking about this. So let me try to come up with the Cliff Notes version of what to say. When we're talking about memories, we have so many different types of memories. So for people who are not super into psychology, the bird's eye view is, think of your memory as two different types, right? We're going to call it explicit and implicit. Do you remember? Do you know how to ride a bike? Do you remember when you learned to ride a bike? Okay, so this is how I usually explain the two types of memory to people. The ability to ride a bike is what you call your implicit memory. It's not some, you don't actively think, okay, my leg goes here and my arm goes there, and then this is what I'm pedaling, and this is the angle, and this is the speed. It's not something you actively think about. It's something you just know. And then the time that you learned how to ride a bike, whoever taught you, or something specific about that moment that you can think about, like, oh, my first bike was pink, or I was taught by this professor. That's your explicit memory. So before we deep dive into how memories affect mental health, it's really important to understand that there are some memories that are sort of implicit, not things we think about. And there are some memories that are things we can think about. Now, I focus more on the explicit memory side. That's typically what we think about when we talk about memories. Okay. But there's really interesting work also coming out now about implicit memories and how that affects mental health. Like, there's been recent research about children being left in the dark and that being traumatic for them, or even PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, being triggered by different things. And it could be that implicit memories come back to haunt you, so to speak. Going back to explicit memories, though, two types. One is semantic, like who's the prime minister of our country. So that is semantic memory. You know this information, right? What did you eat for lunch today? That's episodic memory. That's something about you, right? So now both of these also affect mental health in really different ways. When you're talking about semantic memory, which is just facts about the world that you've picked up, that affects your mental health, and that being able to retrieve that information could be crucial for you to function every day. Mm-hmm. Like, can you imagine going in to work and forgetting what, let's say you're a trader and you forget how the market functions? That just can't do, right? So explicit memory and semantic memory within that is important to make sure it's not going to cause confusion. But if you're thinking about episodic memory, and I think this is a long-winded way of getting to where we want to get to, which is memories about you, about your life that are specific to you. How does that affect mental health? And I think there's a lot of really interesting research being done in this field. My own research, along with people who research nostalgia, have shown that your episodic memories are actually really good for mental health for two different reasons. One is that they're a good reminder of showing you that at one point in life, you were accepted and you were loved and you had all of these connections. So it's a good way to reaffirm your self-worth. And then the second reason that these episodic memories can be good for you is for you to be able to understand how you're feeling in the present, and also for you to be able to simulate how you're going to feel in the future. You need some sort of guess, right? You need some sort of mechanism to be able to figure out that, oh, okay, I see rice in front of me. Is this going to be tasty to me or not? Or, oh, okay, I want to be a lawyer in the future. Have I enjoyed having conversations like that in the past or not? So for you to be able to make sense of the present and the future, your memories are so crucial. So it's not only important in making you feel accepted and warm and welcome, it's also important in you being able to process and appreciate not only the present and the future. So if you ask me, I think the past is making a comeback. I'm happy to get more into the science and my specific research, but implicit memory has been coming back to haunt people. Semantic memory is important in being able to keep confusion at bay, and episodic memory is good for you emotionally, but also to be able to process the present and future.
So, you know, you briefly touched upon the idea that, you know, like, for instance, nostalgia plays a role in, like, improving your sense of self-esteem and self-worth, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about, like, the role which memories specifically play when it comes to, like, improving our mental health?
Sure. So it's funny to think about how the word nostalgia came about. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the history of nostalgia, but it was actually thought of as a disease. And it means the pain caused by longing for home. And almost a century ago, we actually had people looking for the bone in the body that caused nostalgia and trying to remove it, because it was thought of this problem that people are sad all the time and thinking about it in a different part of the world. Of course, now it's evolved. And the reason nostalgia plays a positive role in our lives, aside from making sense of the present and future, is the sense of, okay, I'm here right now, but I remember this time when I was a child when my parents did this loving thing for me, or I remember this time in school when I did really well. There's really interesting research that when people feel lonely and when their mental health feels low, they naturally default to these memories. So if I'm feeling like I'm not a great academic performer, at least for a certain part of the population, their brain defaults to a time in school where they've done well. If you feel like you're all alone, your brain defaults to a time that you were loved. So it's sort of like when you're having these negative thoughts, you have this defense mechanism built in to pull from your memories and show you that, no, that negative thought isn't always true, okay, that you have a counter in your past. Now, of course, if you talk about people who deal with depression, the ability to find counter arguments in the past is diminished. And so I was involved in a really interesting study where we had people who were dealing with depression come in and sit down, and we asked them to think of 10 to 15 happy memories, and most of them said they couldn't.
Right.
And that we don't even have 10 to 15 happy memories. You know, where are we going to come up with this from? So it turns out everybody does have happy memories. It's just the ability for you to go back into the past and have that defense mechanism, that link gets broken sometimes. It gets weakened sometimes. So one way to deal with that is to sort of build yourself triggers. Have around you things that remind you of happy times. Like if you were fantastic as a student in elementary school and you're struggling a little bit in college, have your elementary school uniform or logo on your table or something. So as something as simple as that, seeing the logo in front of you could bring back the positive memories of that time and then reaffirm yourself. So that's a little bit about how nostalgia and trigger systems can be used when that peak, the link is weakened. Mm-hmm. My work specifically revolved around increasing happiness, reducing loneliness, and improving psychological well-being. So what we did was a very, very controlled study around memory jars, where we had people come in to a room. They all had glass jars. We had them think of any 7 memories, whether they were happy memories, sad memories, that was up to them. They put down these 7 memories in the glass jars, shut their jars, and then we measure their happiness, loneliness, and psychological well-being again. We already know what we found. We've repeated this several times. But even when the participants came back a month later, and I think this is a really interesting bit, even when they came back a month later and read their memories, which took them 5 minutes, the same happiness boosts and loneliness reductions and psychological well-being improvements were there. So that shows that it's not necessarily the act of journaling the memory or documenting it. That's the only thing that's good for mental health. It's also just having a trigger for your happy memories or any memories really that's good for your mental health. And then the last piece that I'll say about this, which hasn't gotten as much research as it should, I think, is the idea of rumination, right? When we talk about memories, a lot of people do think about how repeatedly thinking about negative memories or being stuck in a rut, like after a breakup, constantly replaying a relationship's memories in your mind, or after you've lost someone, constantly thinking about them. That is one instance where memories, for example, aren't so good for your mental health. So there is something to be said about how memories clearly affect mental health, but there has to be a conscious way that the recall is done in. If you just sit and live in the past, you're not going to enjoy the present or the future. I think there is something to be said about curating your memories and about setting up triggers and about doing it in a thoughtful way to organize your narrative. That's what leads to these positive effects. Happy to unpack any of those, but memories really do affect your mental health. So you want to be careful about how you're engaging with them.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's very interesting. You know, that's a point that you brought up as well around, like, you know, people who might be struggling with depression and things, because it shows you how your emotional state sort of affects the kind of things that you're going to recall as well. But, you know, moving forward, and I'm sure you've seen it with, you know, your work at NAMHA as well, that in this sort of digital age and with social media, like, people have become very involved in terms of, you know, documenting memories, whether it's through photographs or videos and things. So what do you think that, you know, the impact that this is having in terms of actually, you know, people enjoying the moment, as well as how is it affecting the way you make memories?
I think that's a really important question, and I'm going to answer this in two parts. The first is, how is the memory getting encoded, which is when you're actually experiencing the event? How is this smartphone access actually affecting that? And then the second piece of it is, after the event is actually over and that memory is being created in your head and is going into your long-term memory, how is that affected? So if we're talking about the part where the memory is actually created, right? Imagine that there's a hippocampus, which is the part of your brain that actually does this memory creation for you. Imagine that that's a director of a movie, right? So if you've got a movie going on and the world in front of you is the set and all of the people in front of you are all of the actors, you've got this little director in your head, and you need the director to be paying attention. And you need the director's lens to be paying attention to the relevant pieces that you want to capture for your movie, right? Let's say if you've got a massive action scene happening in front of you, but there's a waterfall on the side. If your director's camera lens is focused on the waterfall, you're going to miss the action sequence happening in front. That action sequence isn't going to get on film, and then it's not something that's going to make the final edit because it never got captured. So the way I think about this is, your attention is what affects where that director's lens is facing, right? If you're at a concert and your attention is on the song the artist is playing, all of the perspiration of the bodies around you, the beer you're probably drinking somewhere, if that's what you're paying attention to, when you think of that concert, that's what you're going to remember.
Right.
But if your attention instead is on your phone camera, and if you're capturing the best angle, and if you're creating something live for someone else to see, if those are all of the things you pay attention to, you're going to miss the beer, and you're going to miss the way the speakers move, and you're going to miss the people next to you. So I think, to bring it back to your original question, having smartphones and the ability to document everything around us has shifted attention a little bit away from the actual experience. And because of that, we're encoding less of the experience and focusing more on the documentation bit. So the amount we take in off the memory is actually missing. Right. And even if it does get pulled into our camera, that's something we watch retroactively. And there are things that our camera can't capture. Like your camera is not capturing the taste of that beer or the smell of everyone's perspiration. It's capturing the visuals. And even then, it's this little half inch perspective. It's definitely not 360 you could have. So that's a little bit about how smartphones are affecting our memories. We're just, our memories are less rich, in my opinion, because we're taking in less information because we're so focused on documenting.
Right.
Another piece that I spend a lot of time working on, which is once the moment has passed, mm-hmm. how is it we're thinking about it? Because, and I think this is a misconception, right? When people think about memory, they think that, okay, this is a cupboard and my memory is a file in the cupboard, so I'm gonna go pull out the file, read it and put it back. And that's kind of not how it works. When you access a memory, you're actively changing things about it. Like if you think about a moment and you're happy, you will remember that moment as happy. If you think about a moment and sad, you remember it as sad. Every time you access your memory, you're rewriting over it. And so when you're accessing memories and you're doing it, let's say to post on Instagram mm-hmm. or to post on Facebook, you're thinking about how other people are going to react to that memory. Yeah. And so it's no longer your experience. It's your experience along with so many other people's reactions. Like, let's say you go to the Bahamas and you have a wonderful time looking at the dolphins. And then you post your profile photo of you at the Bahamas looking at dolphins. It's no longer going to be you with the dolphins in Bahamas. It's going to be you with the dolphins in Bahamas and the 500 people that liked your post instead of the 700 people that should have. And that one auntie who commented about your outfit. All of that is going to get attached to your memory, whether you want it or not.
Right.
And one thing that's important to me is understanding that not all memories are meant to be public. And you don't necessarily want to share all of the experiences right. with the whole world, right? Sometimes your memories are yours, or a memory that you share with a significant other is for the two of you, a memory you share with your families for your group. It doesn't have to be for the whole world. And you don't want everyone coming in and altering a memory for you. That's kind of why the dilemma, to make sure that people have these private memory jars where they can share memories with the relevant people without needing to share it with the whole world. But I definitely think that having smartphones takes away richness of the memories, increases the longevity though, because it builds triggers. Mm-hmm. And the way we share it affects how we think about it later. So we definitely want to be thoughtful about the different platforms we're using.
I think I'm going to come to another aspect around, you know, memories, which we see more memories, experiences, which are more specific to certain occasions, like be it Christmas, New Year, you know, Valentine's Day, New Year's Eve. I think there's a lot of expectations that people have around these occasions. So where do you think, you know, these expectations are coming from? And how do you think that's changing the way people are going to, you know, engage with the day, it's going to change the way they make memories around it. How does that affect the experience overall?
The expectations are so cultural. There are so many days where I sit down and think about the person that invented the idea of a birthday and how much havoc they probably caused in people's lives. Or even if you think about the person that came up with Valentine's Day, or you know, more recently, the hype around engagement rings and diamond sizes, which we know has come from the diamond industry. If you think about almost all of these moments, they have started off with capitalistic roots, so you know where it's coming from. But I think the more interesting question now is, we know that our society frames expectations around these holidays in a certain way. What happens when we have these expectations, and how does that actually affect us, right? I think there's this really interesting study that was done at Dartmouth a couple of years ago. It was about kids and Halloween. Mm-hmm. And so they sent these kids trick-or-treating, and then they divided the kids into four categories. So one group of kids got bubblegum. One group of kids got a chocolate. One group of kids got a chocolate and then a bubblegum. And then the last group of kids got two chocolates. So you've got bubblegum only, chocolate only, two chocolates, and then chocolate followed by bubblegum. Who do you think was the happiest?
I think it just depends till they find out what the other person got, right?
Yeah, I mean, comparison is a huge part of it. But the kids who got one chocolate were the happiest. And now just think about this for a second, right? You've got a group of kids who have one chocolate, and you've got a group of kids who have one chocolate and one bubble gum. Theoretically, the kids that have chocolate and bubble gum should be happier than the kids who have just chocolate, mm-hmm. right? But that's not how the mind works. The kids, once they got the first chocolate bar, expected a second chocolate bar. And when they were given bubble gum instead of chocolate, they're like, well, this is terrible. My whole Halloween is ruined. Why can't I go to a place that has a chocolate bar? Whereas the kids that just got their chocolate bar, they didn't care. They got a chocolate bar. They were so happy. And, you know, they had no expectations or anything for the second piece of candy. So I think that's a good example of how expectation of certain things happening can really ruin the whole experience for you, right? If you have an expectation of, I'm going to get a 4-carat diamond ring, and you're given a 2-carat diamond ring, you're going to be unhappy. Whereas if you had an expectation of no ring and you're given that same 2-carat diamond ring, you're going to be thrilled. And so I think expectations are sort of like a benchmark, and where you land in the experience is relative to the expectations beside how happy you are about this. There's this really amazing study about orangutans and monkeys and how their brains react to expectation and reward. Happy to talk more about that, but just generally, whether you enjoy something or not depends almost entirely on your expectations, or at least your awareness of them, so you can calibrate all of them.
So then, you know, just building a little bit more on the expectation part, and, you know, we can come back to the study you mentioned around the monkeys, but, you know, how do you think that, you know, the expectations will affect someone's mental health more specifically? Like, let's say, as you said, what if your reality is very different from the expectation that you had around that holiday or occasion or event?
Well, it can go both ways, right? If you think of your expectation as a baseline and you have something that far surpasses that positively, you're going to be twice as excited, twice as happy, think this is amazing. And then if you have an expectation and what actually happens on the holiday doesn't match that, which is more often the case, at least from what I've been hearing, then you're going to be doubly sad about it. Even if it's still great, you're not going to appreciate it. The kids that got the chocolate bar and the bubblegum did appreciate it because, you know, their expectation was so much, and then this is what they ended up getting. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think your expectations influence your mental health. I think the more interesting conversation is, how long does this effect last, right? Like, let's say, we're talking in terms of numbers, let's say your expectation was to have a 5 on 10 Christmas. Okay, so you have a 6 on 10 Christmas. So like, oh, this is amazing. I can actually have a 6 on 10 Christmas. So by the time your next Christmas rolls around, you expect a 6 on 10 Christmas. Mm-hmm. And then you have a 7 on 10 Christmas. So the next Christmas that rolls around, you expect a 7 on 10 Christmas. And the thing with this is, the expectations don't stay flat. They keep moving in a certain direction. And it's endless. The more you have, the more you're going to want. Right? And fortunately, I suppose, the same thing happens in the other direction. Let's say you expect a 5 on 10 Valentine's Day. You get a 4 on 10 Valentine's Day. I think my hypothesis is it moves slow in the other direction. So by the next year, you expect a 4.5 on 10 Valentine's Day. Again, you have a 4 on 10 Valentine's Day. The next year, you expect a 4 on 10 Valentine's Day. So I think while it does affect how happy or sad you are about the holiday, your expectation of it, of course, we also do have the ability as humans to learn from it. And I do think that there are several mental health issues that stop us from learning from it. For example, if you have, let's say you deal with seasonal affective disorder, for example, you might have a 6 on 10 Christmas, even though you expected a 5 on 10 Christmas, but your brain won't calibrate to the 6 on 10 Christmas for next year because you will feel like maybe you're not worthy of it. Maybe that was a fluke. You'll try to attribute it away, so your expectation doesn't change accordingly. So yes, it affects your emotional state in the short term. In the long term, your expectations should adjust, but there are certain mechanisms and mental health issues we deal with that even stop our expectations from adjusting.
And, you know, also moving forward, like, you know, we're almost 2 years into the pandemic, and I think it's really changed the way, you know, people celebrate and the way they've made memories and the way, you know, you've engaged with people. And one of the things around, like, the big occasions is that they've always been very social events. You know, you've been around people, and that's what you traditionally associate with the holidays. So how do you think, you know, like, things have been different, and what are some of the learnings that have come out of COVID, especially in terms of the way people are making memories?
Wow, I don't know if it's in my pay grade to answer that question. I can talk from my experience of what I've heard from people using Llama and using Llama to document memories, as well as my own personal experience, of course. I think one important factor to consider when making memories is what makes something memorable, right? Because everything that you see and everything you deal with is not something you remember. For example, if you ask me what I had for lunch last week, I have no idea. If I ask you, I'm sure it'll be similar. Like, you know, you won't know. So there are certain pieces that go into creating memories and making sure they last. And the pandemic has changed our access to them. The first one that we've discussed is investing attention, which, you know, hopefully the pandemic hasn't altered that much. The second piece of a memory that helps you remember it is novelty of experience. People tend to remember their firsts a lot. People tend to remember, like, let's say you go to a different country and you taste a dish you've never had before. Like, let's say you go to Egypt and you taste kosheri. You're going to remember that versus if you eat the same pav bhaji in your town every time. You know what I mean? Like, the first time you do something, a novel experience, is something you remember. And I think the start of the pandemic was novel for a lot of people. They were baking sourdough bread and, you know, finding different ways to connect. But I think after a while, as that novelty wore off, and because of the lack of travel and the lack of human interaction, we lost access to some of that novelty. Mm-hmm. We lost access to a huge piece or characteristic of what helps us make memory. And then every day started feeling the same. And you say 2 years now, but in my mind, it's like just 2 weeks ago before the pandemic started, you know, because so much of it has blurred together. So I think one really impactful way that the pandemic has changed how we make memories is taking away our access to novelty. Mm-hmm. And then what you said about connection is also really true, right? And I think it ties to novelty in that if it's just you and yourself, you will keep having thoughts, but unless you have new things you're exposed to, you're just going to keep having similar thoughts over and over, which takes us into rumination categories from what we discussed before. But as if you have another person with you, there's some freshness they're providing. That other person is going to change what you're thinking about. You're going to have interactions. And that in itself could lead to lots of new memories being formed, mm-hmm. which right now aren't happening. And one demographic that I see with a lot is school and college students, particularly the younger ones, like the ones in nursery and first grade, who've never been to class before. Their way of forming memories of relationships is so different from our way of forming memories of relationships. Mm-hmm. For us, we think of the first time we saw someone, what they smell like, what it feels like to sit next to them, how fast we run. And there are so many different characteristics that go into our memories of people. Whereas a lot of the kids that I talk to through Llama for education is, for them, it's like, yes, this is this person's face. And this is how this person reacts to the mute button. And when someone else says this, this is what this person does. So their memories, in my opinion, feel a lot more reactive and limited to the Zoom boxes, yeah. rather than being multimodal. And obviously, it's too early to predict, but I genuinely think that the pandemic has made our memories almost two-dimensional. Because so many memories are being created through screens. And even when it comes to birthdays and anniversaries and things, we are interacting with people, but it's through screens. That I find it really interesting to see if this change in two-dimensional memories versus the ones we used to have earlier is a permanent learned behavior, or if we revert back. So yes, I think our novelty going away and memories becoming two-dimensional are the two biggest changes I personally see in memories.
I think, you know, that's very interesting because, you know, how earlier when we were talking about screens and, you know, the whole concert example, the whole point was that when you made memories, you were like in a physical space almost. So you were like engaging with people, you were engaging with your environment, and you were picking up a lot of sensory clues. Like, I feel like right now we're sort of not getting any of those cues from our senses, you know, like even if we're having this conversation, it's through a screen. So yeah, I mean, you know, what you said about kids, I think it's very hard to predict, like, you know, what those experiences are going to be like. How are you going to engage with actual human beings? How are you going to engage with, you know, like actual situations versus all of that happening on a screen?
I was just going to say that also ties into so many conversations going on about the metaverse, right? Because if you want the metaverse to resemble the universe, are you going to have touch replicated in a digital system? Are you going to have sound and smell replicated in a digital system? Are you going to have taste replicated in a digital system? And how is that going to affect how people actually deal with the universe? Like, are kids born and brought up in the metaverse going to know what to do with their skin and other sensory organs? Because humans technically have at least 12, if not 27 sensory organs, right? So are we going to remember to even use them? And is the film director in our mind going to be able to draw in all of the perceptions? So I just think that's an interesting question.
Also, like, you know, given the fact that now we're in another new year and, you know, like, people have a lot of expectations and coming back to that whole thing, a lot of hope around the new year that, you know, things are going to be different. And I think, unfortunately, if 2021 taught us something, it was that, you know, my God, it was absolutely not different if it wasn't worse than 2020. So, you know, what would be some tips that, you know, you would share with the audiences in terms of especially, you know, managing your expectations and making memories through the year? Because yes, as you said, we're losing that sense of novelty. There's a lot of mundaneness that's come into our lives. Everything feels very same. And it just feels like one big chunk, you know, it just feels like we went from like March 2020 to whenever. This whole phase in between is hard.
Oh, 100%. And I love how you said people are hopeful about the new year. Sometimes I look at it and I'm like, please just don't be another 2021. Just don't be another. I don't know, it's kind of hard to give general tips, but I think one question I ask myself is, when you're about to do something, whatever it is, ask yourself if you're going to want to remember that 10 years from now, right? So if it's going to be you sleeping on a Saturday afternoon, great, versus you going out and having an adventure, you're probably going to remember the adventure. So just asking yourself this question of, is this something I'm going to want to remember 10 years from now, often leads you to make different decisions that help create a more memorable life. But other than that, I think one relatively easy thing is to create some novelty in your life. For example, I try to do new things every weekend, or at least talk to new people every weekend. So it's a new experience, and it doesn't feel like more of the same if you're doing something new every weekend. Like, I had this phase where one weekend I downloaded a Chinese app to learn Chinese, and then the second weekend I tried cooking myself a meal, and then the third weekend I tried going to the grocery store. These were all experiences I hadn't had earlier. And so that entire spectrum where I was doing new things is memorable to me. So ask yourself, if 10 years later you're going to want to remember this, do something new. Mm-hmm. The third thing that I would say is build triggers around you. So make an effort to document your memories meaningfully just for you rather than for the whole world. We feel like our days aren't memorable, but there is something memorable that happens every day. It's just we choose in the grand scheme of things not to remember it. And I have this thing where in Lamha, I add one memory every day, no matter how big or small it is, right? So sometimes it's just, today the food was less spicy. And sometimes it's something as amazing as, oh my gosh, returning to the cinemas for the first time since the pandemic. And the beauty of these memories is, regardless of how big or small it is, when you look at it later, they both feel valuable. That meal you had a year ago also feels valuable, and that movie also feels valuable. So what I would say is document what's going on around, because the very act of documenting something makes it valuable to you. Mm-hmm. So naturally, again, going back to what we've discussed so far, ask yourself if you're going to want to remember this, try to come up with new experiences, and actually document the experiences you're having. I think these are the three takeaways that at least I'm leading 2022 with, and hopefully they're useful.
Right. No, that's really interesting, you know, and also one more thing that people have, you know, faced a lot in the pandemic is sort of a sense of isolation. And we know that, you know, being lonely is different from being alone. And you mentioned as part of your research that you did find that, you know, for people engaging with memories and memory jars, it reduced a sense of loneliness that they were feeling. So how do you think, you know, that the whole aspect of memories and loneliness sort of comes together? Because especially I think right now it can be really helpful for a lot of people.
I think so. And when you think about loneliness, and thank you for clarifying that being alone is different from being lonely. I don't think that's something a lot of people appreciate. Being lonely, based on my research and what I've read from other people, effectively comes down to a sense of disconnect. And this disconnect takes one of three forms, if not all three forms of people. The first and the most obvious one is a sense of disconnect from people. It's that feeling of, even if you walk into a crowded room, you just feel like no one's going to understand you. You're not going to understand anyone. And there's just, if there were tiny threads that tethered you to each of those people, then it's just broken. And that's the most common one. But there's also a sense of loneliness when people feel disconnected from their own bodies, and that they might feel like, okay, yes, I know that I have a friend in South America and I have a friend who lives down the street and I know I can't see them right now, but they exist. At the same time, this physical form that's sitting on this chair isn't me. Mm-hmm. And so loneliness can also come from this disconnect from your own body. And the third one, which is in my experience the rarest that exists, is a sense of disconnect from the world and more specifically from nature. It gets a little arguable because people make chemical explanations for, you know, loneliness, nature and stuff. But there is a sense of, you know, in your mind that you have people you can reach out to. You feel connected to your body, but the computer in front of you doesn't make any sense. And that tree or those birds that you used to see aren't coming anymore. And so what I've seen memories do really effectively is act as a link in reminding you that you're not disconnected, that the connection between you and other people and the connection between you and your body and the connection between you and the world exists, even if it might not be the strongest anymore. Mm-hmm. So what that does more specifically is it tells you that you're not lonely. You might be alone right now, but you're not lonely because you have all these connections, and it acts as a signal for you to go and take advantage of that. Like if you are feeling lonely and you're not so connected to people and you're able to remember times, let's say, where you had amazing times in college, you know that link between you and your college friends is there, even if they're not physically around you, right? So you can strengthen that weakening link again by requesting a phone call or by saying you're going to go out and get a safe coffee. So what memories do is remind you that the connection is there, and then it's up to you to go and strengthen that connection again. Right. So the way memories work is sort of by reminding you that the links might be weak, but they're still there. And then hopefully you act on it. It's different when, again, you're dealing with depression and issues like that, where you don't pull up memories that remind you of the connection. For example, if you're dealing with depression and feeling lonely, you're going to remember all the times you were alone. You're not going to remember that time in college where you had a lot of friends. You're going to remember that time in college sitting on the parapet and crying. And so you have to make sure you have your locus around you to remind yourself of the good times and snap out of it accordingly, get help when needed. But I do think memories serve as an important reminder of the connections you have with the people around you, your body and nature.
I think also one thing specifically I'd like to ask you is, you know, because we're talking about mental health and especially if we're looking at depression, how do you think people can actually remind themselves, like consciously make more effort about like the good times that they've had? Because that can be the hardest part, right? In terms of recall and coming back to your emotional state, like affecting how you're going to recall things.
It is. And I think there are no two patients who are dealing with this who are the same. But I think generally what I've seen work well, the locus method I've been alluding to through the conversation, which is have triggers around you that remind you of specific things, right? There are some memories that are untainted, and it might be hard to access them at first. It usually takes professional help to access them at first. We've tried a light version in Lumha where you get these professional prompts for free, so you can just answer them. But you need help accessing the memory one time, and the moving from, it's important for you to find something that reminds you only of that.
Okay.
One thing I've seen work surprisingly well is people make memory dishes or specific food that reminds them of specific memories. Like if you want to remember that holiday you went on with your family, remember a specific food you ate only on that holiday. And so seeing that food again reminds you of that happy memory of going on the trip with your family.
Right.
If it's something you want to remember from, let's say, a specific class in school, like let's say an art class, and even having something as simple as a color pencil that you might have used only in that art class on your desk is important. So what I mean is, you either have physical objects, that's not always feasible. You could have a photo album on your phone, you could have a memory jar in Lumha, just any particular phrase or word or object associated only with that memory, and finding those is easier than you think. Keeping those around you is a really good way to bring those good memories to the forefront of your mind and being thoughtful with constructing your locus too. Like if you know, for example, that being in office leads you to feeling more strongly than being at home, then in office you want to have twice as big a locus as you do at home, for example. So it's a changeable concept, but definitely having identifiers around you are easily accessible is helpful.
That's interesting. I think, you know, like just about, you know, keeping things around which take you back to specific times, and it doesn't have to be something physical. But, you know, now that we're moving into, you know, these conversations around that there's going to be a new normal, what is something that, you know, you want to see more of in the new normal?
Kindness. I know that has almost nothing to do with everything we've spoken about, but no. I genuinely think that being kind means being empathetic and self-compassionate. So I don't only mean that, you know, you see an animal on the street and you're nice to the animal. I mean that you look around you and you're understanding to the people around you, and you look internally and you're understanding to yourself. So just a general sense of kindness, both outwardly and inwardly, is something I hope we take, because I know the pandemic has led to lots of reflection for a lot of people, and hopefully that reflection translates into action with them.
That's something, you know, which definitely I think, you know, people need to be able to, you know, as you said, not just be, you don't have to be just kind to other people, but also to your own self, like, you know, giving yourself that space, having those boundaries, mm-hmm. and knowing that, you know, even if you're going to say like no to someone else, that's fine, as long as it's coming as a form of self-care. But I'm going to wrap up with one question to you, Shia, and that's going to be that, you know, if you had some advice for anyone who's watching this or listening to this right now, who might be having a hard time with their mental health, what would that be?
Can I say download Lumha?
Go.
No. I would actually say that. But aside from downloading Lumha, I think the most important thing is to be patient, especially with yourself. I think the conversations around mental health are happening. I think they're too few and too infrequent, even though they're getting better. So you do have to be very patient with the people around you. There are going to be people who think you're lying. There are going to be people who think you're making stuff up. There are going to be people who just don't understand what's going on. And you have to be patient with the people around you. But more importantly, like I said, be patient with yourself. Because everyone's progress happens at a different rate. It's not like by just identifying the issue, you're going to magically solve it. So being patient with the people around you and also with yourself is important. And, you know, it's just, even if whatever you're dealing with has won a battle or two, the war is long and you're going to win in the end. So don't give up.
I think that's really helpful. And, you know, thank you, Shia, for taking our time and, you know, joining today and sharing with us so many different insights around memories, mental health, and, you know, a lot of different things that also came up through the course of the conversation. And I'm sure it's going to be very helpful to anyone who's listening and watching today, you know, just to know a little more, because I think this is something we talk about, but we don't really reflect upon enough, that, you know, how much our memories actually impact the way we feel, the way we go about things as well.
Well, I hope so. And thank you for having me. Hopefully this is useful for people. I mean, yeah, thanks.
I'm sure I will be. And so lastly, for anyone who's watching this today, if you're having a hard time, you know, with your mental health, we'd just like you to know that, you know, you're not alone in what you're going through. There's always help out there and it gets better and you deserve to feel better. So please look after yourself. And till next time, please stay well and stay healthy. Thank you.